So the request last week was intellectual property, right? My computer was acting up this week, so I had to like borrow mostly from someone else's source sheet and add to it because I did, like it is not working to make my own, but that's fine. So the question that we want to deal with is, does halakha recognize the idea of intellectual property, meaning the notion that you can own a copyright, a trademark, right? You're not owning an object, you're owning the rights so that someone else can't reprint your book, can't republicize your song, can't take your prototype and build something else, where obviously the object is not yours, all the materials were theirs, but the idea was yours. Can you own that in halakha? So, before we look at the sources, let me throw it out to you. What questions do we need to ask to figure out? Yeah. Good. So one we got to figure out is, what is ownership? Right? How does halakha view ownership? And is the way that we conceptualize ownership the type of thing that we can expand to intellectual property? Good. What else do we have to ask? Yeah. Very good, right? These are the obvious questions, right? We both need to analyze what does it mean to own something, and things like what does it mean to own? Can I retain ownership? You know, I allowed you to buy my book, right? So I sold it to you, but I want to retain partial ownership, meaning the right to not let you copy it. Can I do that? That's like half the series of questions. The other series of questions are, well, what exactly is intellectual property? Right, if you want to know whether you can own it, you got to figure out what it is. Right, normally classically, you're talking about objects. Right, my phone, my wallet, my whatever. Good. Now, this is only one layer of it because this all assumes that the question we're asking is fundamentally, intrinsically, does halakha recognize intellectual property, and if so, to what extent? Then, obviously, there's the possibility that it might be that halakha would have to recognize it not internal to halakhic discourse, but external. Through what mechanism? Right? There's always this magic mechanism in halakha, which is dina de malchuta dina, which is, even if we don't recognize it, we recognize that there's halakhic value to secular law, so maybe, practically, we would have to recognize the value of intellectual property, but only because we borrow it in systems which recognize it. So, a little introduction, and we'll look at some sources. So, the original questions about intellectual property began really after the printing press, when Svarim started to get printed en masse, and people who didn't want their Sefer to be copied without permission started writing into the introduction of the book Charamim, right? Prohibition that they would write a curse against anybody, a curse, prohibition, whatever, against anybody who would dare and copy the book without permission, right? And once people started doing that, the postgame had to deal with the question of whether that is something that we think halakha allows you to do. So if you want just an example of this, because I'm going to try to change it, so forgive me that it's going to go out of order, but I'm not giving, you know. But look, for example, at 22. Okay? So in 22, this is the Haskamah of the Shalah to the Tosfot Yom Tov. So Tosfot Yom Tov is a commentary on the Mishnah. Shalah is a prominent posek, Kabbalist. What? Oh. Someone told me they gave it. So, on the table? Someone told me that they put them out. I hope they did. If not, are they there? Over here? Yeah, there you go. Like I said, my computer was just really acting up, so I had to borrow from Josh Flug and then try to add a few of my own somewhere, but it didn't work right. What? 3 pages. But like I said, we're not going to do all of them because these were printed before our conversation. So don't kill me. look, I have this problem that I really find it hard to cut down on sources. It really takes a lot of effort and self-control. I'm not like, you know, one second, I'll show you. See, those are the sources I gave to you. These are the sources I had for myself, right? Right? So, like, the ratio of the sources that I give to you, even when I give you that, like, this is... Oh, I didn't make that. Okay. We'll see how we do this. You can try copying. We'll see how this goes. Okay. So the Haskamba the Shalah, for those who have it, otherwise share or make a copy. So he writes as follows. I'll just read in the middle. He says, "Vani yodeu makir de isha alufa now, ki lo asa lolit gader, velo menachit aserbo, ki pizur hono lekayim ze elivan veyu et nahe lefana b'mitzvot b'niyar nahe v'yo nahe v'yodeu machkimot." He said, "I know the author. The author didn't print this book to get rich. He did it because that's what he thinks God wants. And part of getting his Torah out there was getting a good printer and nice paper and nice lettering and printing and binding. But that costs money. And therefore I see two things. Raya Rishana, Shimalei Haaretz Deya Mizeh Chibur. The first thing I can attest to is that this book is going to fill the world with wisdom. Point one. Right? Riachor. Now the second thing I see in this, Kizu Torah Vizu Schara, this is the reward of Torah Shia, Nifsad Votam Rubah Vajum and Kiso. But he said, but I know how much it cost, and therefore, Al Pia Dvarim Ha'ilah, based on this, he goes there, right, so I made a gzera, I make a decree, Shal Yud Pas, Mishnayot, Im Shum Perush, Miyom Shigamer Atfuz, Aklot Arba Shanim Kidei, She... I make a decree that no one can reprint this commentary for 4 years. I give the author copyright for 4 years, and then it's in the public domain. So it's things like this where people asked, are you allowed to do that? Okay. So, like I said, there are many different models to deal with this question. What would be the smoothest model if you wanted to say unequivocally that halacha recognizes intellectual property? So what type of source would you look for? A source that says what? Right, obviously, the Gemara isn't talking about copyright. So what would you look for? Right, would you start with the question of what is ownership, or the question of what is intellectual property, and can I wrap my hands, right, my head, hands, legal, whatever, around it? Which would you start with? Which do you think would be the smoothest way? Yeah. Okay. So why do you think that's more fundamental? Already implies?
And so you gotta know what that is before you can truly define that.
Okay. So you wanna start with that question. Fine. So let's push it a little bit farther. When we say that we're talking about intellectual property and we want you to own it, so what are we really saying? Right? You wanna start with the ownership question. So what are we really asking? What are we, right? Let's highlight the problem here. What does it mean to own in this context? Or let me ask it by contrast. If I say I own my phone, what do I mean? This is not like a trick question, right? What do I mean? Yeah.
Nobody else's.
And what does that imply, like, in terms of my rights to it? I have full rights. What can other people not do with my phone? Anything, unless I give them permission. It's mine. this gets tricky because, as I started off with, many cases of intellectual property don't mean that. Right? What is intellectual property? Right? What is a copyright? It doesn't mean I have full rights and you have zero rights. It means I wrote a book, you paid me for the book, I'm giving it to you. But the question isn't whether you own the book or I own the book. Everyone agrees who owns the book. Not the writer, but the buyer. Right? Everyone agrees to that. That's literally what happened. You bought the book. So the question of ownership is not... it's not like the phone. What is it really? Can I retain some of the ownership, the rights to not let you copy, right? Or the rights to not let you disseminate, even though I admit that I sold you the book, right? Or you fully legally paid the money, you downloaded my song, right? I am now a hit singer. In theoreticals, you can do anything, right? So you downloaded it and you paid good money, whatever it is, on Spotify, on iTunes, a dollar, whatever it is. You bought it. It's done. I agree. You have it. You can listen to it. You can do whatever you want, except you can't copy it and give it to somebody else. You can't play it at a party without getting permission from me. You can't put it on a video, if that video is going to go into the public domain. And if we're focusing on the ownership question, it's a different question than in what sense do you own your phone? Or your house. But when it's phone, house, what you're saying is I own it, you don't. But by intellectual property, you're saying, if I sell you my book, can I retain the ownership only in the sense that you can't do certain things for it? And even within that, as we know, there's different types of violations of intellectual property, right? Some are you can't use it in a public forum, but you're allowed to, there's fair use. Does it depend on whether I'm copying it for reasons that are within the fair use exception? Does it matter whether I'm copying it for myself? I mean, let's say, is there a difference between whether I say, look, I'm only going to buy one copy of, I don't know, whatever, pick your favorite book, I don't care, right? Whatever it might be. But look, I don't want to carry the whole book. I'm going away for the weekend. I'm realistically only going to read two chapters. I don't want to carry the book, or I'm going to be reading it outside on my hammock, and maybe I'll fall asleep, and maybe it'll rain on me. I don't want to ruin the book. I'm going to copy the two chapters that I think I'm going to get through before I fall asleep in my Shabbos afternoon nap, right? I'm not going to give it to anybody else. It's for me, right? So that's one. If the owner says, "But I told you you can't copy," that's one type of limitation. It's a limitation where you're presumably not losing money, because he's only buying one copy of the book. It's just that he wants to have multiple copies to himself, or she wants to have multiple copies for herself. There are other cases where you're saying, I don't care what you do it in your own house. Is that I don't want to lose money because you're going to disseminate it for free and I want other people to pay me. Those are different questions. So if we want to zero in on the ownership question, what we're really asking is, to what extent does halacha recognize the possibility of maintaining ownership on something even when I admit that the basic ownership I already gave to somebody else? Right? If I want to sharpen the question, do we agree with that? Right? There is another potential model, even within this, that you could entertain, and that's as follows. Maybe you could argue that the question isn't ownership at all, because let's say I write a book and then I sell the book to someone fair and square. They pay me the, whatever it is, $25 for the book, and then they do disseminate it. what am I going to demand in return for the violation of copyright?
Money.
Now, one reason I might do that is because we have posited some type of ownership that will explain that the right to copy you didn't own, and therefore you stole that from me. But it's possible that that's not really what we're asking at all. There's another possibility, which is, what are we asking? Does the fact that you used my property and benefited in a certain way that could have provided me with income, can I demand that income to me? Not as like I own it as much as you benefited from my retained rights. It's not that I'm saying you stole it as much as I'm saying the fact that I maintain the rights means that I deserve the royalties. And therefore, you have to pay me the royalties that would have happened. Right? That's a slightly different model. Right? And both of those are in some way on the ownership plane of it. So I'll be honest that if you want to go historically, chronologically on this halachic question, most poskim did not focus on the questions I just focused on. But in the very modern period, some poskim have in fact brought those back into conversation and said that the right questions to be asking about whether halacha recognizes intellectual property are those questions. Okay? And most extensively in recent years was Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, who was a posek, a major posek in Yerushalayim. He was an interesting posek. He was, I guess, part of the Haredi world in a sense. He's Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach's son-in-law. You know, he's a dayan and the Rosh Yeshiva of a Hasidish Yeshiva, the Sadigura. But he was also the Rosh Yeshiva of Machon Lev College of Technology. And he also taught at Eretz Chemda, which is the religious Zionist Dayanut Kolel. And he also was one of the two main authors on the RCA's halachic prenup, which is like, you know, the standard prenup of the modern Orthodox community in America. So he was a very interesting, broad person who didn't really fit in a box. And he very extensively wrote about intellectual property, and he thought that the right questions to be asking were these questions. Okay? So let's pause here, and let me show you some of these sources. Try, for those of you who have them, how many sources are we short? Because this is not good. Can we share, or do we have to make I think you can make copies also, right? The copy machine's over there. Try sources 6 and 7. Try sources 6 and 7. And start with 6 and 7, okay? 6 and 7, the Mishnah in Bava Batra and the Gemara in Bava Kama. And see what that, right, where that takes you. And if you really want to be ambitious, then you can try 13 and 14 also. So 6, 7, 13, 14. But start with 6 and 7, and if you want to do more, do that. And let's say 15 minutes. Try 15 minutes. Okay, so the first case, the first category, the first type of category that we discuss is based on the following. So, what does the Mishnah tell us? The Mishnah describes, as we said, the case where you have two adjacent properties, and the person who owns the outside property starts building a wall around, on the border between himself and the inner property. So, Hamakiv et chavero mishalosh ruchota vegadar rishona v'rashniya v'rashlishit. So the Mishnah tells you that the inner person, right, the inner property owner, does not need to contribute financially at all to the investment of the outside builder as long as only three walls have been built. What's the logic? Because, let's say, Reuven lives on the inside, Shimon lives on the outside. Reuven will say to Shimon, look, A, I didn't ask you to build the wall, or Sarah and Rachel, okay? Whatever you want, doesn't really matter. I didn't ask you to build the field, to build the wall, so why do I owe you anything for your investment? And B is you didn't do anything for me, because in the end of the day, on my fourth side, my property is open to the public. So it's not like your wall did anything. I mean, from my perspective, it's aesthetic at best, but it's not functional. Right? It doesn't do what a wall, what a fence is supposed to do, which is protect me from trespass. Rabbi Yossi Omer, and Rabbi Yossi says, but im amad v'gadaret ha-revi'it, if he gets up and builds the fourth wall, mir galgalin alav et akol. So then we make him pay for all of it. Now there's a lot of ambiguity packed into that sentence. First ambiguity is, im amad, if he stood up and built the fourth wall, who's the he? What are the two possibilities? Outside or inside? So, the Gemara says, the Gemara has this machloket. And the Gemara said, who is the person building it? Is it the, what we call the makif? Meaning the person who was already encircling the property continues to encircle it? Or is it the person who's on the inside? Now, what would be the logic of saying the person on the inside, when he builds the fourth wall, he becomes chayev? He becomes liable? Yeah. Correct, right? When you build the fourth wall, you show that you wanted the whole thing, because now you are tagging along. What's the logic, though, and this is the surprising one, what's the logic for saying that if the person on the outside property goes and builds the fourth wall, even though the inside person didn't contribute at all, he has to contribute money now to the wall? What's the logic for that? Very good. So if you look at the Gemara in Bava Kamma comments on this and says, Tanan, Hamakiv chavero mishalosh ruchotav. If you build a fence around your neighbor's property on three sides, so first three walls, you're not liable. Harivit, but by the time you get to the fourth wall, mechayvinoto. Shmamina, zenene, vizelo chaser, chayav. From here we learn that if one person benefits and the other person doesn't lose out, he's liable. So, let's skip from it. Let's skip to the focus on the second side. Tashma, Amar Rabbi Yossi. The Gemara focuses on the second half. This is really what I want to focus on. Im amad nikaf egadar darivit migalgalinev alav et akol. So the Gemara has the girsa not just of if somebody puts the wall, but if the inside person builds the wall, Hamakif patur. What does that imply? That if the outside person would have put four walls around it, you would not be chayav. Shma mina, doesn't that teach you that zene nevezelo chaser patur? So the Gemara says, shouldn't that prove that because, just because I benefited on the inside, because now I have four walls, the fact that you didn't lose out, because you were building it for yourself anyways, I am exempt. So the Gemara says, doesn't that prove that hana'a itself, the benefit itself, when it didn't come at a loss to you, is not a reason to create liability? Because it's only if the mak, right, only if the nikav, only if the person on the inside builds the fourth wall, so then we say, you wanted the wall, so you got to pay for it. But if the person, the neighbor, just said, look, I'm going to build you a wall, whether you want it or not, the fact that your property is now protected is irrelevant. Doesn't it show that The fact that I'm benefiting is not sufficient grounds to obligate me in money. The Gemara answers, no. Shiny hatam damar leile didi sagili benetira barzuza. Gemara says, no, it's different. Why? Because the guy would say, look, I do appreciate that you protected my field. But, you know, realistically, you built this nice, beautiful wall. I don't need a wall. I needed a fence. I needed whatever, right? I'm not worried of people trying. I needed something that was going to keep out the deer, right? I don't need a tall wall that's going to keep out people. I wasn't worried. I live in a safe neighborhood. You can't tell me that, well, I protected you from anybody scaling the wall into your property because I built a 20-foot wall made of stone, and therefore you owe me half of that. The guy will say, look, it's very nice that you protected me from trespassers, even ones with ladders and ropes and whatever, right? Only the... But I don't care, right? I didn't want people wandering in and trespassing and animals wandering in, but I didn't want what you gave me. So the Gemara says, that's why the person on the inside can say, I'm not going to pay for the full value of the property. But what's the implication, the Gemara? That he doesn't have to pay the full value of the wall. But what does he seem to have to pay? Correct, right? The value of having a minimal fence, a minimalist protection around his property. And the Gemara therefore says, why? Because the chayav, right? The Gemara had said that the hava amina was patur, meaning that even if I get benefit alone doesn't obligate me if I didn't cause you a loss. If I didn't cause you a loss, you chose to build it, not my problem. And the Gemara rejects that and says, no, it's not true. I can't be forced to pay for the full brick stone wall because I didn't want that. But the objective benefit that I got from the fact that, you know, the value of a fence, that much I do have to pay, even though I didn't contribute, I didn't ask you. But the fact that, objectively speaking, I just benefited from the investment that you put in means that I have to pay. Okay, are we clear on that? So now, the first type of model that Rizalman Nehemiah, or one of them that he brings in, is he says, one language for talking about intellectual property is, right, remember we said, what does it mean to own? So, there are different things. One thing might be that I don't really mean ownership. What do I mean? The fact that I invested work in writing this book, in creating this song, do I have the right to demand monetary payment if you benefit from my investment, right? From my contribution, from my effort? So Rav Zalman Nehemiah says, well, wait a second. What do you see in this sugya? That there is a category in halacha that if what I did benefited you, then you can be obligated to pay. And therefore, one could make the argument that someone could turn to someone who illegally downloaded their song and say, listen, I didn't lose money per se, but I invested work into this. And you clearly enjoyed my song because you went to download it, right? And it's worth whatever it's worth. And if the very fact that you benefit from it, right? Like the person on the inside will say, look, I didn't ask you to build the wall. I didn't want the wall you built. And nevertheless, we say, but objectively, you got benefit from the wall. At least pay the nominal amount of a fence, because that happened, right? In the end of the day, you benefited. That shows that people have the right to demand payment for the investment that you benefited from. Right? Hana'a itself, the fact that I have granted you benefit, is enough of a monetary category. So, one argument Rav Zalman Nehemiah puts forth to argue for some sort of reality of intellectual property is this notion that halacha, we don't even need ownership per se. We recognize that investment that leads to benefit, objective benefit, under certain circumstances, I can demand payment. Right now, he goes, but he knows that if this is the source, if this is the type of source, and again, because I don't want to overwhelm you, you can see there's a million sources that follow this, but I'm just giving you like the keys. He says, if this is the source for intellectual property, so we have to ask a very nuanced question. If I download your song without permission, is it prohibited, or do I just owe you money? Which one? So, here's where it gets tricky. He says, if the model that you use is this type, meaning I can demand payment because of hana'a, because you benefited from what I invested, then it's not theft. Because, right, it's not theft. The guy will say, right, I didn't steal your wall, you built it around my property. Right? I don't have to pay you because I stole the bricks. I pay you because I benefited. So he said, if you use this model, the conclusion you would get is that it's not forbidden to download the song, it's just that by downloading the song, you have now generated a monetary obligation back to the creator of the song. Right? So I didn't violate, I just created a monetary obligation. Now obviously, if I don't now pay it, I'm derelict in my monetary obligations, but it's not theft, because the category here isn't quite ownership as benefit from your investment. Yeah. So very good. And if you go in this direction, then the key question is always going to be, well, what did I actually benefit? If I got a sub-quality copy of the song, you're right, I wouldn't be obligated. But also, right, the poskim say that what else might be true? In the Gemara's case, it's clear that by the end, did the person on the inner one, was he happy? Was he willing to invest money, at least minimal money in that fence? Yes, and that's how we define benefit, right? We say, but what would happen if the guy was kicking and screaming and said, no, I really don't want a fence at all. Like, I don't want a fence. I like open property. I trust my neighbors, and I'd rather have a view, right? So in that case, would he be liable? No, because there's no benefit. He explicitly told you it's not benefit. So some post him say, well, if what you're talking about is benefit, so then it's not just benefit, it's monetarily recognizable benefit. So what if someone says, look, I liked your song. If I can download it for free, I'll download it. But like, if you're going to charge me, so my life won't be incomplete without it. Forget it, I just won't do it. Right? Or, I won't download it. You put up the music video on YouTube, which is a little bit annoying for me to use YouTube to listen to the song all the time. Right? It's annoying. It's easier for it to be on Spotify. But if you're going to charge me the dollar to have it on Spotify, to have it on iTunes, then fine, I'll just listen to the music video on repeat on YouTube. But I would never pay for it. So then, if the question is, did you get monetary benefit, the answer might be, maybe not. Right? Because I didn't get monetarily recognizable benefit. I'm only downloading it because, right, I wouldn't pay in any possible world for this song. Right? If I can get it for free, I'll take it. But if not, I'll find some other way of getting it. Right? I'll only listen to it when they play it at, you know, the next whatever, the next simcha I'm at. I don't know. Right? So this model will have some limitations because it's not really positing ownership. It's positing that in certain cases if you can quantify benefit, it comes from my investment, so I have the right. Right? I in that sense, I own it. So that's one model that he suggests, okay, which is not quite ownership. Now, what's the benefit of this model? Right, the benefit of this model is that, as we said, intellectual property is strange, because sometimes you're talking about downloading a song, but sometimes what are you talking about? Preventing someone from making copies of a book that I already sold them. So if what you're asking is benefit, you could say, look, I sold you the book, but I didn't sell the book to somebody else. So now they copy the book from you. It's not that I think you stole the book. You were allowed to have the book. But he didn't. So he made a copy. And now, it's not that I'm telling you he stole the book. He didn't. I'm saying that he's benefiting from my book without permission. And he values it because he clearly made a copy. So he has to pay me for the book. Right? The benefit of a model like this is that it's not really looking for ownership per se. It's looking for, can I quantify the benefit that you got from my investment? But let's say you wanted to go farther, and you said, no, that's not really what I mean by intellectual property. I don't just mean that I have the right to demand compensation for the benefit you get from my investment. What I really mean is I own it. So then what do you need to look for? You need to look for a source that'll tell you that even once I sell you my book, I can say, you own my book, but only insofar as you're using it for private property. But if you copy it or disseminate it, then you don't own it. Now this gets tricky, because I could mean one of two very different things by that statement. Okay? So what two things might I mean by that statement? If I say to you, I'm selling you my book, but only for private use and not for dissemination. So what might I mean by that statement? What do you think? Yeah. So that's one, right? That's one type of question, but I should be clear in terms of what I'm asking. By what, if I have the power to stop you from doing that, what gave me the power, right? What does that reflect about the nature of the transaction, the nature of my ownership, that I can tell you that you're not allowed to disseminate my book publicly? What does that tell me? Yeah. So one possibility is that there's such a thing of what the poskim call shiur. I can sell something, but not entirely. Right? I can sell you my book and maintain certain rights in the book. That's one possible read of what I could be saying when I say, I'm selling you the book, but for private use. Which is, I'm giving you some rights, but I actually am maintaining ownerships. I'm not selling you the whole book. It looks like I'm selling you the whole book. I'm not. I'm selling you the private usage of the book, but this book is not really completely yours. It's partially mine. That's one conceptualization. There's another conceptualization that's possible, though, which is not what we call shiur, right? A remnant, a maintaining of rights in the book, but a tenai, a condition. That what I'm really saying is, look, the book is 100% yours. On condition you don't disseminate it. What's the difference between one and two? Very good. Right? It's possibility two is, look, you totally own it. But if you violate my conditions, then what happens? The sale reverts. Right? The sale reverts. Because it's a tenai. Now let's think about it. One of those says that it's possible to sell partial ownership and maintain partial ownership. The other one, can you maintain ownership of something you've already sold? No, that's not what you're doing. You're just saying, it's totally yours, but if you violate our conditions, so then you have to give it back and I have to give you back the money. Meaning you've reneged on the, right? That basically you violated the conditions of the sale. Now in copyright, which of those conceptualizations would grant room for intellectual property and which one wouldn't? Yeah? What? Very good. Right, the sheer one. Because think about it. If you think that what it means when I say I'm giving you the book on condition that you don't disseminate it is a tenai, Then, let's say someone takes your book, scans it, and puts it as a PDF online. So now, what is your claim against them? Your claim is, you violated your rights to the book. Give me back the book. I'll give you back your $25. And that's it. That's the end of my claim. That's not intellectual property. That's saying you violated the conditions of the sale. So you give me back the book, and I'll give you back your $25. But if I don't want to give you back your $25, you don't have to give me back the book. Because that shows I really didn't care about the condition. So in order to conceptualize intellectual property as being about ownership, I have to prove that there's such a thing as shiur. Right? That it's possible for me to sell a property, and even though I'm really selling the property, I'm really selling you this book, I'm somehow magically maintaining rights in it. I'm maintaining rights in it for the purpose of not letting you disseminate it further. I'm selling you private usage rights. So, if you look at 23, the Gemara has a case like this. And the question is, it's clear that in certain circumstances I'm allowed to do this. But the question in the Gemara is, how do you conceptualize it? As a shiur or as a tanai? Right? As proof that there's such a thing as partial selling or as a condition. So look at the Gemara in 23. The Gemara in Bava Metzia in Chet tells you, "Detanya Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar Omer Mishum Rabbi Meir, Hanotein Dinar Ani Likach Lo Chaluk." If I give money to a poor person to buy a shirt, I tell him, "I'm giving you $50 to buy yourself a shirt." Lo Yikach Bo Talit. He can't buy a cloak. Talit. If I tell him I'm giving you money to buy a cloak, Lo Yikach Bo Chaluk. So you can't buy a shirt. Bibnei Shima'avir al da'ato dibalabayit, because you are violating the intentions of the owner. And then if you skip down to Gemara, the Gemara has a little bit of right technicalities in the case, and the Gemara says, V'cholam ma'avir al da'at shal balabayit nikra gazlan, and when you violate the will of the balabayit, so you are a gazlan. So Rav Zalman Nechemya looks at this Gemara, and he says, this Gemara proves the possibility of shiur. That the reason that the poor person has to use the money for what the owner said is because shiur. There's such a thing as maintaining rights. I gave you the money, and it's really yours. If you use it to buy a shirt. If you don't, right, I gave you the money, it's yours to buy whatever shirt you want, but you gotta buy a shirt. If not, I maintain the rights in it. And therefore you're a thief if you don't. Right? You're a thief if you use the money for something else, because I maintain my rights in it. So Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg looks at it and says, aha, you see there's such a thing as shiur. So maybe the same thing is true in intellectual property. I sell you the book with the rights to private property, to private usage. And what does the Gemara say? That if you change your mind and you go against the Dat Balabayit, what is that? Theft. Why? Because Allah recognizes this ability of impartial, of imperfect, or incomplete sales, where I maintain rights even though I gave it to you. But many of those who critiqued Rav Zalman Nechemya said, many people don't believe that the proper conceptualization here is shiur. What do they really think it is? Tanai. And if it's Tanai, so then all you could prove from this Gemara is again the following. That if I sell you a book and I say I'm giving it to you for private usage and not to disseminate widely, that I can tell you, oh, if you upload the book in PDF online, so then I have the right to demand that you give me back the book and I'll give you the $25. But that's the extent of my rights. But this doesn't prove intellectual property because you don't own it. All you did was you put it tonight. So now he violated the conditions, so you have the right to negate the sale if you want. But you got to give him back the money. Right? You can demand the book back. But that's not what people want. They don't want the book back. What do they want? The right to prevent you from disseminating it. So there's this major machlok, and again, because, again, my disclaimer for the 100th time, because you don't want me to overwhelm you with sources, you'll take my word for it that many sources fall on both sides of this question, but this is what they're arguing about, is if you conceptualize it as shiur, as this Gemara proved that there's such a thing as selling something but maintaining rights, then we have a language to talk about intellectual property. Okay, we're going to have to leave it, but let me make one last point before we go on. One of the main critiques that was made against Razam Nechemi Goldberg on this, on both of these points, was the following. One second. This is the... What I have in my hand here is the original article by Razam Nechemi Goldberg, then the response article to Rav Zalman Nechemia, and then the response of Rav Zalman Nechemia to the original author. So it's very, very long. So there was this back and forth in Tchumen Vav and Tchumen Zayin, where Rav Naftali Bar Ilan critiques Rav Zalman Nechemia. And he says, look, I've got an overarching proof that neither model that Rav Zalman Nechemia introduced is right. Now, he has a million detailed ones. So, if you're interested, you can go through it. You probably have a whole set of tchumen either here or upstairs in the shul. Many shuls in Israel do. I'm pretty sure you do here. He says, I have a very simple proof, which is that Poskim have been arguing about intellectual property for 400 or 500 years. Who is the first person to apply either the argument of shiur, right, that there's this possibility of partial sale, or the notion that you might be liable for hana'ah, even without, per se, ownership violations, to the world of intellectual property? Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg. And he said, you're not the first person to talk about copyright. You're not the first person to talk about intellectual property. And what Rav Naftali Bar Ilan says to Rav Zalman Nechemia is, look, I agree with your conclusion that there's such a thing as intellectual property. But you can't tell me that after 400 years of people arguing about intellectual property, nobody ever raised either model that you just said. That must not be the proper conceptualization of why Halacha recognizes intellectual property. So he says, look, I'm willing to accept the conclusion, but I'm not willing to accept your rationale. And what we'll see next week are the classic models. Which is, okay, then what have people been saying for the last few hundred years? If they're not saying what Zalman Nechemia says, meaning that there's possibility to maintain ownership, shiur, or that the use of my intellectual property is hana'a, which can be demanded in court, right? Monetary rights to hana'a. If it's not that, then what is it? Okay? So what we'll do next week is see some of the more classic ones, and then spell out some of the nafkemina, right? Nafkemina, the implications of it. Okay.